The composer of this music was nominated for an Academy Award in 1958. It's the score for The Big Country, and it brought Jerome Maross his greatest fame, not least because it exerted a huge influence in the film industry.
I was very excited about doing that, and without knowing it, I seemed to have turned out the prototype Western.
When Maross came along and infused his films with a homegrown Americana, it really changed everything.
Jerome Maross so vividly painted the character of the Wild West in such a newly authentic way that the Big Country's music became the model for a Western movie. And that's all the more remarkable in that Maross was not primarily a film composer. Although he wrote quite a number of film scores, his greatest love was the theater, where he was a major innovator. In 1938, Frankie and Johnny was a very new kind of experience for an audience having a night out at the ballet. Its subject and Maross's musical treatment of it was quintessentially American, and it immediately went straight to the heart of an urban world that the composer had personally experienced.
Frankie and Johnny is truly a classic, and it's like a great American novel or a great poem. Sometimes it's gritty, sometimes it's poignant, but it's so real.
And Jerome Maross was an inspired songwriter.
It's a lazy afternoon, and the beetle bugs are zooming, and the tulip trees are blooming, and there's not another human in view but us two.
And he was a master of orchestral tone painting. That was a glimpse of A Tall Story for orchestra, and before it, Lazy Afternoon from the Golden Apple. Songs, ballets, opera, musical theater, film scores, and orchestral and chamber works of Jerome Maross are featured in this two-part program as we commemorate the ingenious composer's centenary. I'm Michael Feinstein, and I'm delighted to be your host for this documentary on the life of an artist whose brilliantly imaginative creations have had a special place in my heart for quite a long time. Joining us for this anniversary celebration are many distinguished musicians and historians, family members, and from the archives, recollections from the composer himself, Jerome Maross, The Big Country, and beyond. On August 1, 1913, Jerome Maross was born into a Jewish family of Russian émigrés living in Brooklyn. From his childhood, he was immersed in the musical ambience of New York, which provided some of the earliest inspirations for his precocious talent as author and executive director of the Society for American Music, Mariana Whitmer, tells us.
He started playing the piano when he was 5, and he started composing when he was 8. And he was just fascinated with music, and it was all around him in New York City. And he was born in Brooklyn, but spent most of his youth in New York City. And he was just fascinated by all kinds of music that he heard and he performed, and he just loved it.
It wasn't just these sounds of New York that captivated Jerome Maross as he grew up in the big city. When he was just 14 years old, he managed to sneak in, unnoticed and very unofficially, to a rehearsal of the New York Philharmonic Orchestra under its legendary conductor, Willem Mengelberg, and he was mesmerized. How all that happened is quite a story, which Maross told to Craig Reardon in an unpublished interview in 1979. And although the sound quality of the recording is poor, we're including it here because of its unique value. Maross and another budding young composer, Bernard Herrmann, were both attending the DeWitt Clinton High School when they met for the first time, in unlikely circumstances.
We were in a German class, and I was sitting in the back of the room so the teacher shouldn't disturb me while I was composing. And I looked up and I see a boy sitting across the aisle, twirling his hair, studying the Mahler Fifth Symphony in an Eulenberg miniature score. He looked at me and he said, "Do you know Mahler?" I said, "Mahler stinks," or something like that. And got quite angry and grabbed what I was writing and looked at it and tossed it back at me and said, "Dishwater Tchaikovsky." So we started to argue because I felt he hadn't even looked at the thing. And suddenly the teacher was calling the two of us up and said, "Stand up, you know, get out." And I said, "There, you see, you got us thrown out of the class and we won't even know what the homework is." I was upset. Oh, he said, "Oh, forget about it." He said, "You know, you want to go to a rehearsal of the Philharmonic?" And I said, "How can we go to a rehearsal of the Philharmonic?" He says, "There's a broken door." So we walked over to Carnegie Hall and we went on the entrance to the studios on the side and climbed up to the dress circle level, and you walked down the hall, and there was a broken door. And we walked in and kind of got on our hands and knees and crawled. And then we just peeked our head above our eyes, above the level of the balustrade in front of the dress circle. And it was Mengelberg. And we watched Mengelberg rehearse for the next hour. And we became friends.
The orchestra and the conductor that Jerome Maross and his new, and as it was to turn out, lifelong friend Bernard Herrmann heard in 1927, the New York Philharmonic and Willem Mengelberg. And this recording dates from just the following year. The music, Ein Heldenleben, is by Richard Strauss, and he was a particular favorite of the young Maross. Already, in just his early to mid-teens, he was exploring a large and adventurous repertoire, often in the company of Herrmann.
The two of them just palled around together and experienced as much music as they possibly could. And then they would perform an awful lot of music together. Hermann played the violin and Maras played the piano, and they would read through tons and tons of music, all kinds of European works.
At the same time, Jerome Maras was becoming more and more interested in the sounds of the popular music he heard in New York. And that was one of a number of reasons why he was an unconventional student when he enrolled at the Juilliard School of Music, and also, simultaneously during his final year there, at New York University.
Outside of taking a composition course, studying composition with somebody, which the Juilliard wanted us to do, I felt that any teacher you had would impose his form, his style upon you. And if I was going to have a style, I'd find my own style. I wasn't going to start off from Mr. X's style.
He went to Juilliard. He studied the classics. He learned composition and orchestration and all of that. But he took that, and on top of that foundation, he kind of impressed upon it or assimilated all of this American music that was going on around him. And his big love was the theater, and he spent a lot of time playing for theater. You know, he played the piano, he played in the orchestra pits and around town, and that music and the music from the jazz clubs. And his grandson tells this great story about Maras taking his younger brother to a carousel because he wanted to hear what a carousel sounded like, and adapting all this music around him.
My grandfather was kind of a young man about town. And his younger brother was somehow sort of, my grandfather would take care of Charlie, I suppose you could say. And Jerry would say, let's go off and hear carousel music, because maybe he was thinking about writing something with carousel music. So the two would go off to Coney Island, and they got some beers, and they sat there and they listened to the carousel.
Popular music was all around me, and it always seemed absolutely right to use it. And as a matter of fact, Charles Ives, with whom I was quite friendly in my late teens, Ives was very kind and very helpful. He once told me that he thought it was a good thing that I was mixing up real popular music in my style,
right.
Which at that time, by the way, was quite Schoenbergian, Webernian, you know. It was very intent upon quarter tones and
really,
and all the rest. Then I suddenly felt it was a dead end, and I left it.
Just you alone.
and it's up for me to be taking myself and moving myself along. And I'll be dragging what's left of me to my lonely room in the blue and never come back and never crawl back till I'm through just hugging me.
An extraordinarily original composition for a 19-year-old. That was Jerome Maross's The Everlasting Blues, his setting of words by the experimental American poet Alfred Kremborg. And before that, we heard Jerome Maross in conversation with Paul Snook on WRVR in 1970. Also, Josh Tarjan, the composer's grandson, who was telling us about his grandfather's visits to carousels with his younger brother. Maross composed Those Everlasting Blues in 1932, and it was written in something of a transitional style, combining the atonal music of Schoenberg and Webern that he mentioned he soon moved away from, and the strongly expressive character of jazz and blues that he loved so much. It also surely recalled Charles Ives, too, whom Maross was remembering before, a composer he particularly admired and loved for the truly American character and atmosphere in his music. Altogether, he was already absorbing an enormously wide range of artistic influences with his voracious cultural appetite, as his daughter, Susanna Maross Tarjan, explains.
The essence of him was a cultural, intellectual person. He was always reading, he was always thinking, going to every type of art show, concerts, whatever, in New York, not just the big things, but the offbeat stuff. And he was interested in everything, including science, and he loved baseball, and he was kind of an all-around guy.
And he was always exploring and reading right up to the end of his life, as Susanna's other son, Aaron, recalls.
I do remember observing him, and he read. He was this voracious reader. He always had a stack of books by his bed. And it just seemed to be, you know, four or five, and he had tons of books there in where he would write, compose. There was a whole wall of books, and he basically read everything. It wasn't just a library for show. It was a library that he'd actually read. And he read Euclid to learn geometry. So.
Well, one of Jerome Maross's very greatest literary interests was the medium of words for theatrical stage performance. And his desire to write music for the stage soon came to fruition. In May 1935, his first major stage work opened in New York. Parade was a political review, and although it was never recorded commercially, we can give you a short sample of it now, because David Raxon, who orchestrated the show, made a home recording of a couple of numbers from it all those years back. Here's David singing Life Can Be Beautiful, and accompanying him on the piano is Jerome Maross.
Life could be so beautiful. Life could be so full and free. There's everything in the world to make it so. No reason why it shouldn't be. Life could be so beautiful. Life could be so grand for all. If just a few didn't own everything. And most of us nothing at all. There's food enough and clothes enough, and plenty to spare, there's room enough, and work enough, and plenty to share, there's plenty for everyone to live without care. Life could be so beautiful. Life could be so full and free. There's everything in the world to make it so. No reason why it shouldn't be.
Well, there's some magical history. The composer Jerome Maross accompanying David Raxon and Life Can Be Beautiful from his first major stage work, Parade, in 1935. And that private home recording comes from David Raxon's collection. Well, Parade included a tune from a composition Maross had written the previous year that had originally been intended as a dance piece for the choreographer Charles Wideman. In fact, it had made its debut as a purely orchestral item in a CBS radio program. Maross created a word of his own for it, Begin. Begin by Jerome Maross. In the same year that the composer incorporated a melody from it into Parade, that's 1935, he was in charge of the music for a staging of Bertolt Brecht's play The Mother. He takes up the bizarre story for us in this conversation with Charles Amerikanian, recorded in 1979.
Some friends and I had started a theater called the Theater Union. I was kind of music director of it. And in an unhappy moment, we decided to do Mother by Brecht, based upon the Gorky novel. It destroyed our theater. Brecht came over, but he came over with his wife, mistress, and another girlfriend, a new girlfriend. And you know, this entourage, he walked down looking like a priest with his head. His hair was cropped all over his head. It was about a quarter of an inch. And he looked like a cowl, you know, a monk's cape or something, and he'd march down with his somber mien, trying to frighten everybody, and being nasty as whenever he could. Well, I remember when Kurt Weill came to this country for the first time. I had met Kurt in Europe, and I went to see him, and he was living at the St. Moritz, I know, remember, on 6th Avenue and 59th Street, and I told him that Brecht was here. And Kurt turned absolutely ashen and said, "Don't tell him I'm in New York. Don't tell him I'm in New York."
Jerome Maross recalling Bertolt Brecht there in an interview with Charles Amerikanian of the Other Minds Audio Archive. Maross was very friendly with Kurt Weill and, quite importantly, Aaron Copland, who strongly believed in him and soon made a vital recommendation when he introduced his work to the innovative choreographer Ruth Page. That led to his first collaboration with her in Chicago in 1936, a daringly feminist ballet called An American Pattern, which strongly takes sides with the plight of a frustrated housewife in a bourgeois society. Ruth Page and Jerome Maross partnered so well that they both scored a landmark success in their next collaboration just 2 years later. But before that, Maross experienced what can only be called an epiphany. He was on his way to the west coast of the U.S. for the very first time, actually to be the music director of a tour of Gershwin's Porgy and Bess. Dance historian Jack Anderson and Mariana Whitmer explain what happened.
Maross, on his first trip to the west, got out of a train in Albuquerque and walked to the edge of the city and beheld the desert expanding beyond him and was absolutely floored by it. And when he got to California, he was absolutely floored by it in yet another way. Maross was captivated, bowled over by the American West.
He was just amazed by the whole scenery, the mountains and the openness. And he said that this is what inspired him when he composed A Tall Story for Orchestra. And he wanted to express that sense of openness and wideness and awe.
Thank you.
This is very personal to him, I think, this tall story. It was the experience he had of crossing the country and discovering, as an Easterner, discovering the American West and being just dazzled by it and trying to create that vista, that landscape that so moved him in his language, but in a different way, that he treats this in such a beautiful, beautiful, expansive way.
A Tall Story for Orchestra by Jerome Maross, composed in 1938, and the conductor of this performance, Joanne Faletta, was speaking before. That first visit to the West was to be the inspiration behind Maross's most famous composition 20 years later, his score for the film The Big Country. And it was during the tour to Los Angeles with Porgy and Bess that Maross had received a phone call from Ruth Page asking him to return to Chicago to create with her a new work that he himself had actually suggested to her while they were working on An American Pattern. It was a groundbreaking concept, and it was to be a watershed, not only in the career of Jerome Maross, but also in the history of American ballet and, indeed, American music. It was called Frankie and Johnny, complete with Maross's ingenious incorporation of the popular folk ballad of that name into a tense and highly strung score vividly evoking a grisly world of crime, violence, and tragedy.
Frankie and Johnny is a very urban ballet, a ballet that takes place in the slums about infidelity and murder in a very gritty section of a big city.
It gave Maras an opportunity to work significantly with ballet and particularly with vernacular ballet, getting away from the traditional tales and the traditional movements and working with more folk narratives and modern kinds of approaches to ballet.
It explores a story from the seamier side of the American vernacular, but with such fierceness and such love at the same time. I mean, you can tell that he is into this. I mean, he believes in the power of this ballet. And he also had a certain special sympathy for women. And it seemed to me that in his portrayal of Frankie, there's a kind of special attention play to the power of women and the fact that maybe, they haven't always been treated fairly.
It called for three Salvation Army girls who played percussion and sang at the same time. They played a tambourine, cymbals, and one had a bass drum. And I thought it was rather amusing that the Salvation Army girls, who would be in a slum parading around trying to save souls, would be singing the narrative of what was then considered a very naughty folk poem.
One of the most unusual touches of Frankie and Johnny are the three women in Salvation Army uniforms who from time to time break into the action and sing verses from the old ballad, the old folk ballad about Frankie and Johnny. And that was considered unusual at the time, and it still is unusual when you see it today. The program called them Saving Susies, possibly as a tactical way of avoiding any conflict with the actual Salvation Army, which might have been offended. And especially since towards the end of the ballet, the Saving Susies lift out of nowhere beer glasses and take a swig of beer.
This story ain't got no moral. This story ain't got no wasn't there something of a scandal?
It was in New York, most particularly. It was just at a time when the play called Trio had been banned by the city fathers, who were shocked at Trio's subject. And Frankie and Johnny opened a few days later, and one newspaper had a headline, "The City Produces Dirty Ballet." You know, it was a ballet risk production at the city center. And
but the choreography was not really that suggestive, was it?
Mm, it was quite frank.
Oh, really? Yeah.
It really was quite frank.
Well, if Frankie and Johnny, with its daring pairing together of the sacred and profane, caused shockwaves in New York, it also established a strong new public awareness of Maross's innovative and unmistakably individualistic style as a composer for the theater. Commenting on it before were Mariana Whitmer, Joanne Faletta, Jack Anderson, and the composer himself. Frankie and Johnny premiered in Chicago in June 1938, at a time when finances were tough for Maross, as they were for many people then. The lure of the West and Hollywood's thriving film industry held out a chance for more lucrative opportunities, and so in 1939, accompanied by his new wife Hazel, Jerome Maross went back to California for what was to be a new, if at first unpredictable, phase in his life. That music was written for the film Our Town, which appeared in 1940. It wasn't composed by Jerome Maross. Aaron Copland wrote the score, but the orchestrations for it were made by Maross. During the next several years, before he wrote his first film score, and indeed even when he was writing music for films, Maross was one of Hollywood's most valued orchestrators. He explains why that came about.
I got out to Hollywood and I couldn't get a job as a composer, though I already had a Broadway show done by the Guild. I had lots of ballets done, concert pieces done, orchestral works, etc., commissions from Columbia Broadcasting, and then I was considered too modern. Mm-hmm. So I became an orchestrator. I got a job at Warner Brothers, and I orchestrated for, I became a very successful orchestrator. I hated it, and then I stopped it the minute I could do films.
Well, he may have hated doing orchestrations, but his presence as an orchestrator in Hollywood was very valuable for him and for Hollywood, as Susanna Maross-Tarjan, an orchestrator and arranger Larry Moore, comment.
He orchestrated a lot of films for many years, and he always felt that that was fabulous training because he could orchestrate something in the morning and hear it in the afternoon. And that way he could hear what worked, what didn't work. And he always felt that even though he had had a lot of orchestration training when he went to Juilliard, this was really wonderful training, and he really was a marvelous orchestrator.
If it's a good collaboration and the orchestrator is working with the composer, very often the orchestrator finds something that the composer never thought of, or vice versa. Maross did the orchestrations for The Bishop's Wife, with Cary Grant and Loretta Young. And they are fantastic. They're very magical. It's a Christmas movie, so it's full of bells and lots of carols and things. And he didn't write the score, but the orchestrations just bring it to life.
Thank you.
The Bishop's Wife premiered in 1947, and during Maross's time working as an orchestrator in Hollywood, he composed his first symphony. It was premiered in 1943 by one of the great legendary conductors in history, Sir Thomas Beecham. How that happened is explained now by composer and former music consultant to the London Film School, Rodney Newton.
He showed it to Sir Thomas, he gave him a copy of the score, and he took it away. And he thought, well, that's at least I've made the effort. And all of a sudden, the orchestra manager at Seattle rang up and said, oh, Sir Thomas is doing this next season. Can you tell me how we get hold of the parts? Well, there weren't any. So he was working in Hollywood at the time, and he engaged a whole army of Hollywood copyists at his own expense to cost him an arm and a leg to copy the parts out hurriedly, and the piece was performed.
Conducting this recording of Maross's Symphony No. 1 is Joanne Folletta.
Although Maross wrote for a wide variety of genre, he always considered himself a concert composer first. I mean, I think that was where his heart really lay. And the symphony is an expression of who he was at his most serious, at his most classical, and perhaps the kind of work that he would himself value most.
A scheduled second performance of Maross's symphony in 1944 with Beecham, this time in New York's open-air Lewisohn Stadium, had to be canceled at the last minute. But the year after that, 1945, Jerome Maross returned to New York to start work on what was to be another watershed innovation and a vital new collaboration. With the writer and lyricist John Latouche, Maross created the first of two of the most productive partnership productions in the history of musical theater. Ballet Ballads is the next work coming up in this documentary. Jerome Maross, The Big Country, and Beyond, our centenary tribute to Jerome Maross, which is being generously underwritten by the Jerome Maross Foundation. I'm Michael Feinstein, your host, and you're listening to this Maross celebration.